It is such a pleasure to be with you this evening at the Commonwealth Club, a place that since 1903 has been committed to finding the truth and setting it loose in the world. I'm Corey Shockey from the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and I have the pleasure this evening of talking with my friend and colleague, Brian Fishman, about this outstanding book, which will be for sale in the lobby at the end of it, and he will be signing. You are, for our listeners who are not in the audience this evening, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Please join us on YouTube. Watch our YouTube videos, join us on Twitter, on Facebook. We want to engage with you. It's your engagement that makes this organization so vibrant and so lively, and that draws terrific speakers like Brian Fishman. Won't you join me in welcoming Brian Fishman to talk to us this evening? So what I should have said before I did that is that Brian is at Facebook. He wrote this book. Well, Brian, I'm going to let you tell them what inspired you to write this book. And in the meantime, you can tell them how we know each other because they're connected.
All right. Well, Corey, thank you very much for being here, for agreeing to host this. Thanks to the Commonwealth Club and George Dobbins in particular. So the master plan as a book began its life in 2008 as the syllabus for a class that I taught at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. And that goes back to where I know Corey from. We were both teaching in the social sciences department there. And in spring semester of 2008, I taught a class about an entity that was then known as the Islamic State of Iraq. And a central question at the time was, what does it mean when a jihadi terrorist organization tries to put down roots and control territory and govern? I think that timeline oftentimes surprises people because people think about the Islamic State as something that sort of emerged very suddenly in the last couple of years. I reject that idea. I think that it emerged very slowly. We just didn't pay attention to it. And I think, unfortunately, that it's going to take it didn't emerge suddenly, and it's not going to go away suddenly either. The final kick for me, just to stay on where the book came from, was in 2014, after the Islamic State that we've come to understand in the last couple of years became very prominent, two of my former cadets from that class reached out to me and said, you know, hey, at that point they were special operations officers, and said, hey, did you ever update the syllabus from that class from years ago? And at the time, I had to say no, but I'd wanted to write this book anyway, and that was, you know, and it sort of procrastinated, and that was the final kick to, you know, when you've got two of your former students that come out and say, hey, this would be useful, that's sort of that's the kick in the butt you need, you know. You're not going to get a better sign than that, so that's where the book comes from, and it goes back to how Corey and I know each other originally.
It's a wonderful, detailed explanation of the way that ISIS grew out of Al-Qaeda and in a kind of complicated relationship, the complicated relationship that Iran's support, Pakistan's involvement, and the way that the wars in Afghanistan and particularly in Iraq and then Syria created a fostering environment in which the strategy that the leadership of the organization had and planned out its trajectory has been remarkably successful. In fact, Brian says in the book that they succeeded brilliantly on this plan. I'd like you to start by talking about what the plan is. Mm-hmm. What are the seven stages? Take us from the awakening forward.
Yeah. So the master plan, the plan itself, was conceived in 2004, and it was primarily drafted by a man named Saif al-Adl. Saif al-Adl is alive today, and I mention that because most of the people I write about in the book are not. Most of them are dead. Saif al-Adl is not. He's alive. And theoretically in Syria today. But he was al-Qaeda's security chief, sort of internal security chief. He was an Egyptian former Egyptian special forces officer, but an Al-Qaeda loyalist. And in 2004, he was negotiating with a man named Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who is Jordanian and is sort of the godfather of the Islamic State. Zarqawi was a very diehard jihadi, more extreme even than Al-Qaeda. And he'd interacted with Al-Qaeda in the years before 2004, but didn't join Al-Qaeda. He thought that Al-Qaeda and the Taliban were too accepting of deviant religious practices. But in 2004, Zarqawi had become the primary foreign insurgent in Iraq after the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. And Al-Qaeda wanted to bring him into this sort of Al-Qaeda brand and the Al-Qaeda fold. Saif al-Adil, at that point, was living on an Iranian military base in Iran in sort of a safe house slash under house arrest. He didn't have freedom to go places, but the Iranians were letting him communicate with the outside world, including with Zarqawi. And what they did is they identified a 7-stage plan that this new joint organization between the Zarqawiist movement, the more extreme Zarqawiist movement, and Al-Qaeda would pursue. I won't go through every single stage, but basically this plan starts in 2000, and in the beginning, the awakening stage is the hallmark of it is the attack of 9/11. The eye-opening stage goes into the invasion of Iraq. And from there, there are a series of stages where the purpose is to bog the United States down in Iraq, to bleed it, and to force, and by bogging the United States down in Iraq, to force everyday people in the countries around Iraq to make a choice. Would they stand with their governments that were supporting the U.S. invasion of Iraq? Or would they stand with what they contextualize as the resistance? And this, I think, is really central for understanding both the development of the Islamic State, is that much of what the Zarqawiist movement has been designed to do is to try to force the people that they can think are their constituency, Muslims around the world, into making a choice, be whether they're going to go with the jihadis or they're going to reject the jihadis. From the Islamic State's perspective, the people that reject the jihadis, which in practice is the vast majority of the world's Muslims, are actually apostates and they deserve to die. And I think that's a really important point, that this group doesn't speak for the overwhelming majority of the world's Muslims. But the most important element of this plan, of the master plan, was stage five and stage six. Stage five was to take place between 2013 and 2016. And it called for the declaration of the caliphate in Syria during that time period, which is exactly what happened. Now, it also called for, during the same time period, by the way, it said that the British, and this is a quote, the British will reject the rising unity of Europe, which also happened. So there's a lot right there. Now, here's the thing, is I draw your attention to the accuracy of that timeline because it kind of gets a murmur in the crowd. Everybody sits up and takes notice. I actually think they kind of got lucky on the timeline, right?
Couple of guys sitting in the basement.
Yeah, they're sitting in the basement. Sometimes you get lucky, right? What's most important about the plan, about the master plan, is their identification of why Syria was the place where they could do this, right? Why was Syria the place where you could put down roots and develop a state? And that speaks to Al-Qaeda's longer-term strategy, right? And why this master plan developed in 2004 was kind of a diversion from Al-Qaeda's traditional strategy. So if you take a class, most academic classes today, talking about Al-Qaeda anywhere in the world, they'll reflect Al-Qaeda's strategy as a quote-unquote far enemy strategy. As Al-Qaeda was designed as an organization from the mid-1990s forward that prioritized attacking the United States, right? And the reason why they prioritized attacking the United States is not because they hated us more or because they hated our freedoms or whatever else we talk about sometimes. It's because they wanted to overthrow local governments. And they didn't think they would be able to overthrow Saudi Arabia, Egypt, etc., if the United States was propping up those governments. Right? And so Al-Qaeda understood, well, we have to sever the United States from those local governments before we will be able to overthrow them. And Al-Qaeda understood this could take decades. It could take centuries. They didn't really care. They thought this was fundamental. It was a long-term strategy. It was a long-term plan. Zarqawi had a much more immediate sort of ethos. He wanted to see results in the near term. He didn't want to pursue some long-term strategy that was predicated on, you know, severing the United States from local regimes and then hopefully overthrowing those local regimes. He wanted, you know, progress in the near term.
So I want to interrupt you for just 1 second. For folks who have not yet read the book, I want to put a couple of basic building blocks in place to make sure that we're all following along with this very detailed, complex story. So Al-Qaeda, which the leadership comes out of the Middle East, they're resident in Afghanistan, plan and execute the 2001 attacks. Zarqawi is a Jordanian who goes to fight in Afghanistan, is considered, as Brian said, radical even by jihadist standards. He's also not a philosopher. He's not somebody who has an idea of the world. He's not somebody. So the master plan, you need to separate the kind of philosophy, the notion about, if I think about Makdisi, for example, somebody who said democracy is the Western religion. That's why it's incompatible with Islam. And we need to force that. So there are big thinking philosophers in the jihadist movement. Zarqawi is not one of them. One of the ways Zarqawi comes to prominence is actually Secretary of State Colin Powell's UN testimony or UN statement. Talk to folks about Zarqawi's role, the way that kind of catapults him to prominence, and then how he uses that. Because I think that discussion is one of the real strengths of your book, and it's a basic building block for the story that you tell.
Yeah, so it's true. Zarqawi was kind of a nobody when he arrived in Afghanistan in 1999. And Al-Qaeda helped him build a training camp during that time period. But he didn't join the organization because he was considered too extreme. And he didn't want to join Al-Qaeda. He thought they made too many compromises. In 2002, after the U.S. counterattack on Afghanistan, he moved to Iraq and began fostering revolution there, began fostering and building the building blocks in anticipation of a U.S. invasion. Now, this is interesting, right? When you refer back to what I was just saying about Al-Qaeda's assumption, Al-Qaeda's geopolitical assumption at the time was that the U.S. was going to prop up all of these local regimes. Well, as the U.S. is preparing to invade Iraq, it directly challenges this core assumption that Al-Qaeda had made about the world, right? Al-Qaeda, not only is the U.S. not going to prop up Iraq, it's going to overthrow that regime. And so Zarqawi walks into this vacuum and capitalizes on it. And the way he capitalizes on it is he makes alliances with local jihadi groups that had existed in Iraq previously, some of whom in northern Iraq had experimented with chemical weapons and these kinds of things over the years. And he becomes the symbol, because he had been embedded in Afghanistan and worked with Al-Qaeda but was not a member of Al-Qaeda, he becomes the symbol for the Bush administration of, and he was in Iraq, he becomes the symbol, though, of this is Al-Qaeda's presence in Iraq as part of the run-up to the Iraq war, right, is Zarqawi. And, you know, you can cut this both ways. Zarqawi was a real jihadi by then. He was the real deal. He was out to kill people. But he wasn't really Al-Qaeda. He didn't have a great relationship with Al-Qaeda. He had taken their money. So this is, this is complex. And but when he was pointed at by Secretary of State Powell at the United Nations as the man in Iraq, rather than Osama bin Laden, before that, when we thought about jihadi terrorism, we all thought about bin Laden. And Secretary Powell sort of points at the danger in Iraq is Zarqawi, and that elevates him not just in sort of the globe's eyes, but that elevates him within the jihadi world, right? I mean, we know from captured in jihadi documents that these guys get a sense of credibility over what price we put on their head, right? So, you know, they value the degree to which we hate them. This was big time credibility for Zarqawi, and it really elevated his stature. Now, what happens in the master plan when Zarqawi gets together with Al-Qaeda after the invasion of Iraq in 2003, they're writing the master plan in 2004, is they look at Iraq and they say, and Zarqawi's arguing, the way that we're going to win in Iraq is we're going to be utterly brutal. We are going to kill everybody. He says, and it gets back to this notion that Corey pointed at of Zarqawi not being an intellectual. Al-Qaeda was very much an intellectual movement. It was designed as a small elite organization. Al-Qaeda had fewer than 200 members on 9/11, by design. Now compare that to the literally tens of thousands of members that the Islamic State has had in the last couple of years, right? Very different ways of organizing. And some of that is that the Zarqawiist movement was populist. And it was populist in two ways. It said, we don't need to listen to religious scholars, even jihadi religious scholars, for direction. The people that understand Islam the best, from their perspective, I'm not implying that this is the quote-unquote true nature of Islam or anything like that, that their argument is the people that understand Islam the best are the soldiers on the front line, the ones that are making the sacrifices, because that is the greatest demonstration of faith, is being willing to fight and kill and die, potentially, for God. And so they're the ones that should be making the grand religious declarations, the soldiers. By the same token, Al-Qaeda opposes and has generally opposed killing Muslim civilians, lay people. They say we need to kill leaders that steer Muslims away from central religious truths, but we don't want to kill everyday people. The flip side of that is that the Zarqawiist movement, again, a populist movement, says we're going to give power to our popular supporters, to the everyday people that support us. We're also going to, from their perspective, hold accountable the apostate Muslims that don't come along with us, even if they are not well-trained theologians. We're going to kill everyday people. And that's a real difference, and that divide still divides Al-Qaeda and the Zarqawiist movement and the Islamic State today.
One of the most chilling parts of the book for me is when you describe in the early phases of the master plan and of Zarqawi in Iraq, the shrewd, calculated brilliance of his decision to first bomb the Jordanian embassy, yeah, to turn up the pressure on regional supporters of the American effort in Iraq, then second to blow up the UN headquarters to drive international organizations out of the effort of helping Iraqis after the invasion, to leave the United States alone standing, looking much more imperial than would have otherwise been, making regional states look much more dependent on us than had been the intention. And then third, the assassination of the cleric in Najaf, to the pointed use of sectarian conflict in the Muslim world, which was so shocking even to Al-Qaeda and the philosophers of the jihadist movement. Can you talk some more about that? And how it affects Zarqawi's relationship with Al-Qaeda in the run-up to the 2004 loyalty pledge?
Yeah, absolutely. So there is, you know, as Corey said, there's these sort of three major attacks that Zarqawi commits in Iraq prior to swearing allegiance to Al-Qaeda. One is against the Jordanian embassy. The second is against the UN headquarters. And the third is against to kill a senior Iraqi Shia cleric that had just returned to Iraq from Iran, where he'd been in exile for years. And this was central to Zarqawi's strategy in Iraq, was to provoke the Shia population of Iraq to kill both religious leaders, political leaders, but everyday people, to provoke Shia Muslims into attacking the Sunni population of Iraq. And what's interesting about this is Al-Qaeda objected to this strategy on two grounds. A, they said, look, the jihadi movement, generally speaking, is a Sunni movement. Both Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State are Sunni groups. But what happens is Zarqawi decides to attack the Shia because he wants the Shia to come back and attack the Sunnis in Iraq. He wants to provoke sectarian violence because he thinks that's the only way he's going to be able to rally large numbers of Iraqi Sunnis behind him. He wants Sunnis in Iraq to be terrified because he thinks only if they're terrified will they come to me and ask for support. He recognized that his ideology wasn't going to appeal to lots of people. He needed them to be terrified. He needed them to come running to him. And this was something that, you know, Al-Qaeda wasn't willing to go that far. And one of the reasons, and this is a major difference between these two movements, right? One of the themes that you see here is that the master plan was a strategic plan built for an alliance between the Zarqawiist movement and Al-Qaeda. That alliance no longer exists. It has broken apart. We'll talk about that in a minute. But one of the reasons why that alliance has no longer exists is because Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State define their constituency differently. So I believe that there are 1.5, 1.6 billion Muslims in the world. And I believe that because the Pew Foundation studies these things, and that's what they say, right? And that's what most people believe, right? Al-Qaeda agrees with us on that. Al-Qaeda also thinks there are 1.5, 1.6 billion Muslims in the world. Al-Qaeda has it in their head that they're going to rally all of those people behind them. Now, they're not actually going to rally all of those people behind them. Al-Qaeda is a fringe movement in the Muslim world. But that's their idea. They see that as their constituency. And they want to kill Muslim leaders, but they want to kill the Muslim leaders that they believe are leading those 1.5 billion people down the wrong path, right? The Islamic State looks at it differently, right? Whereas Al-Qaeda says the problem is how do we lead these people, the Islamic State and the Zarqawiists say the real challenge is how do we distinguish between the quote-unquote true Muslims and the apostates? Because they kind of look the same to us. How do we distinguish? And one of the ways that they say they distinguish is they're going to use brutal violence. And if people are willing to embrace that brutal violence, then they're with us. And if they reject it, then they're against us. And so when the Islamic State thinks about its constituency, when the Zarqawiist movement thinks about its constituency, it's not 1.5 or 1.6 billion people. It's much, much more narrow than that. And this, I think, is really interesting because if you think about this in more traditional political terms, Al-Qaeda thought of itself as having a very small organization, 200 people on 9/11, but a very big constituency. The Islamic State thinks about itself as being a much more popular organization, a bigger organization, but ultimately having a more narrow constituency. And those differences and the operational choices that they lead to are what really made this alliance between the Zarqawiist movement and Al-Qaeda sort of fundamentally fragile and very difficult to sustain.
So as I read your book, it comes quite close to a sort of great man theory of history, right? Mm-hmm. That without Zarqawi, you don't get ISIS. Yeah. I have heard Joby Warrick, who wrote Black Flag, and another very good book about ISIS, argue that without Zarqawi, you actually don't get this civil war in Iraq. Talk us through what Zarqawi uniquely is to this movement and whether you think it could have been perpetuated in to get to a caliphate, right? The declaration of a state, the governance of territory. In your judgment, do they ever get that far without Zarqawi?
No. I think Zarqawi was critical to the development of this movement, both because he was an uneducated, street savvy, you know, kind of street fighter, you know, and Yeah, I mean, but he understood tribal relationships. He understood leadership. You know, when he would sit down, when Zarqawi would sit down with his lieutenants, he loved Kraft cheese. Funny story about Zarqawi. He loved Kraft cheese. And when he would sit down with his lieutenants in Iraq, he would always make sure that they ate first, and he would hand out Kraft cheese slices to them. That's a true story.
Okay, this seems like a good point to ask a scholarly
Sorry,
question.
Sorry, a little bit of an aside, but you know.
No, what I want to point out is that this is an extraordinarily well-researched and sourced right. book, and I'd actually like you to speak about how do you know stuff like what kind of cheese,
yeah.
Zarqawi. Explain how you know what you know about this movie, because I actually think it's a really important part of what this book contributes.
Yeah. Well, so absolutely. So I think just to finish one thought, and then I'll answer that question. I think Zarqawi was central to building the early movement in Iraq, and if you look at some of his writing in 2005, they were laying out the foundation for the Islamic State. He did really begin to have a vision for political transition at that point. And you know, there were a lot of people that came after that made it happen, but he was critical. I do think the civil war in Iraq would have happened without him. I just think it wouldn't have been as beneficial to jihadis. The way we know so much about these groups, there's sort of three big sources that I use for the book. One is when I went to work at West Point, at this place called the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point in 2005, started working on groups in Iraq, including what at the time was called Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was Zarqawi's movement in Iraq. And, you know, you wouldn't believe it today, because there is sort of this notion that the jihadi movement has just discovered the internet, but that is not true. We were on their web forums in 2005, and I scraped a bunch of their web forums in 2005. So I have in the book, as the appendix to the book, is a document developed by the current caliph, quote-unquote caliph, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, from 2005. And I've had it in an archive for a decade and didn't realize what I had until I went back, because we were just pulling all of this kind of stuff. So a lot of the sourcing is just reading what these people say, because they're telling their story to each other, and you have a lot of insight into that. The other sort of big piece that was unique here is that one of the things we were able to do at the CTC years ago was get data declassified from the U.S. Government. And so Special Operations Command, our special operators would raid safe houses in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and we were able to work with them to declassify a lot of the raw documents that they captured during that time period. And so we did a lot of that in years ago. And so that included things like personnel records. When an Al-Qaeda in Iraq or an Islamic State fighter would show up, they would fill out a personnel record. This is my name. This is my address. This is my educational background. This is my mother's maiden name. This is my skill set. They've been doing that for years and years. They still do that today. The other great source that really shed a lot of light on the relationship between Zarqawi and the early Al-Qaeda movement, like 2003, is from the evidence submitted in a trial of a senior Al-Qaeda figure named Abdul Hadi al-Iraqi at Guantanamo Bay. So people don't think about Guantanamo Bay as a place where there are actually trials going on, but there are actually military tribunals going on where they are submitting thousands and thousands of pages of evidence, including raw documents that have been picked up over the years. And a lot of that stuff is online. And if you know where to look, you can find that stuff. There's a tremendous amount of this data that is available if you know where to look for it.
One of the things I did not know until I read the book was Kurdish terrorist organizations in northern Iraq and their relationship with Zarqawi, and that, in fact, you suggest in the book that the ritual beheadings and the videotapings of them and disseminate that a lot of the social media terrorization that we associate with the Islamic State he actually learned from Kurdish terrorist groups in northern Iraq. And yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And it's the segue into talking about what does Zarqawi learn in Iraq, and then how does this carry forward in igniting the violence in Syria?
Yeah, well, I think the Zarqawi moved to Iraq in 2002. He was embedded with these Kurdish jihadis who were very forward-thinking at the time. They had a website in three languages. They videotaped a lot of their attacks. They would print them onto CDs and then mail them around the Middle East for the purposes of propaganda at the time, because you couldn't move a video file. The internet wasn't good enough, right? So you had to print it onto a CD. Zarqawi's, the first beheading, the first of these sort of modern jihadi beheadings, was Zarqawi beheading an American named Nicholas Berg in 2004. Some of you may remember it. And the Islamic State beheadings today are explicitly designed to have sort of reflect the aesthetics of that very first beheading. Nicholas Berg was put into an orange jumpsuit, very similar to the ones worn by prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. And that same model is used by the Islamic State today. I think the propaganda piece is really key. The recognition that that violence, that you don't always have to win on the ground so long as you win the storytelling afterwards. I think Zarqawi learned that. And I think that was really, really key.
One of the points you make really strongly in the book and very persuasively is that that they don't have to succeed on the ground, because a major element of the master plan is just convincing the United States not to care. Where does the withdrawal from Iraq fit in that, and how does it serve as a kind of bridge to Syria from an ISIS perspective?
Yeah. So Zarqawi was killed in 2006. Two 500-pound bombs plus Delta Force will do it. And he was replaced by a guy named Abu Abdallah al-Muhajir, an Egyptian. And then the Islamic State of Iraq was declared in 2006. The Islamic State of Iraq in 2006, no, most folks never heard of it. I wrote a paper about it right after it was declared. That paper was eventually found in Osama bin Laden's safe house by the Navy SEALs that killed him. So they were paying attention. Al-Qaeda was paying attention to this. In October of 2006, that organization developed a cabinet, including a Ministry of Fisheries. They ran basic public works projects. They set speed limits in the areas they controlled. They picked up garbage. Now, the reason we don't remember that entity as being stronger, even though it reflected an attempt to govern in a way that we would be recognizable today in the way that we think about the Islamic State, is because of the surge. It's because of the surge of U.S. troops into Iraq and the awakening. It's because we put 150,000 Americans on the ground at great risk and great cost, and worked with local tribes to reject the group. And that worked to an extent. It suppressed this organization. They lost thousands and thousands of fighters. And then we decided that they were militarily defeated. We declared them militarily defeated. And I think that was a mistake. In 2011, we held two facts at the same time. The Department of Defense said this group has been militarily defeated. It also said this group has between 800 and 1,000 members. Now, that's kind of strange, right? 800 to 1,000 members doesn't sound like a lot when you compare it to the tens of thousands of members that the Islamic State has had in the last couple of years. Doesn't sound like a lot when you compare it to the maybe 15,000 members that the Islamic State of Iraq had when it was declared. But it's 800 to 1,000 members. Sounds like a hell of a lot when you compare it to the 200 members that Al-Qaeda had on 9/11. So depending on how you think about that organization, you really think about its strength very differently. Most of those people were in northern Iraq, near the city of Mosul, and across the border in Syria at the time. And that was the part of Iraq that had the smallest presence of Americans. It was also the part of Iraq that was closest to the logistics lines for this organization into Syria. So it was the place where they were able to sustain themselves. Now, what happens when the U.S. withdrew troops from Iraq, which was in accordance with the Status of Forces Agreement that the Bush administration signed, but the Obama fulfilled that withdrawal. And I think that helped that the Islamic State find its feet again. And I don't think we can, and I generally liked President Obama very much, but I think that's the reality, and it did two things. One, it unleashed the worst demons of the Iraqi government, which acted in a sectarian manner, primarily Shia Iraqi government, which scared the hell out of Sunni populations, which fulfilled exactly what Zarqawi had long hoped for, right, which that Sunnis would rush into the arms of the jihadis. And then the other thing that it did was you lost the intelligence support and the sort of political stability that comes with having professionalized Americans running around, especially in a place that's volatile like Mosul. Now, I think you can make a very good argument, and I certainly opposed the original invasion of Iraq. But I think we also shouldn't be blind to the fact that the way that we withdrew, I think, did enable the Islamic State to get back on its feet. At the same time, that organization was never dead. And there is in my mind, a false sense that that organization had been defeated when it hadn't. It had been suppressed and was operating like an underground terrorist organization. But one of the stories here, I think, of modern warfare and what we've seen with this organization is that the difference between a terrorist organization, an insurgent group, and a proxy or pseudo state is a lot thinner than we thought it was. You can transition between these states of being very, very quickly because of the way global communications works, because of the accessibility of weapons and explosives, because of the ability for people to move around the world. You can rally tens of thousands of people to show up in a place and bolster a nascent political movement in a way that would not have been possible 100 years ago. And so this transition, this ability to transition very, very quickly, I think, challenges a lot of the frameworks that we've used historically to understand the nature of these kinds of organizations and these kinds of movements. And I think it's going to be a real challenge going forward for us.
I'm Corey Shockey from the Hoover Institution, talking with Brian Fishman, the author of The Master Plan, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and the Jihadi Strategy for Final Victory. You are listening to us from the Commonwealth Club in California. Brian, one last question before I turn to this magnificent avalanche of questions from our audience tonight, which is, carry this forward. Right, because the master plan carries this forward.
Yeah.
ISIS has been losing territory in Syria, in Iraq, losing legitimacy because of the violence against other Muslim organizations. But they've got a plan. If you're the ISIS leadership, what's the weather look like? Are you succeeding? If not, how do you continue to prosper based on their plan?
Yeah, so stage five of the plan, as I mentioned, was the declaration of the caliphate between 2013 and 2016. That was to be followed by stage six, which was to be a campaign of global terrorism, unlike the world has ever seen. And that's kind of happened also. Stage seven is very, very ill-defined. And it basically comes down to, we win, right? And where I think... The big thing that the Islamic State has not been able to achieve that is sort of reflected in this old plan is major attacks on Israel. And now one of the things that's interesting about this is a key reason why they haven't been able to attack Israel is because two other terrorist organizations don't want to let them, meaning Hamas and Hezbollah, because Hamas and Hezbollah want to own that is their political calling card. And these terrorist groups don't like each other, right? And we shouldn't, and this is one of the things, as an aside, this is one of the reasons why the phrase radical Islamic terrorism is pretty meaningless. Because if you use that phrase, it suggests you can't tell the difference between Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, Hamas, and Hezbollah. These are all extremely different organizations. They're oftentimes at war with one another. And if we don't have targeted strategies to deal with all of them in different ways, then we are going to fail. So that kind of terminology, in my mind, just obscures the reality of the very distinct organizations, ideologies, and movements that we need to deal with. Sorry, that's a little bit of a tangent. What the Islamic State is going to do now, I think they're upset that they're losing territory. The fact that they're losing territory does matter, because territory means safe haven, and safe haven means training camps, and training camps means you can take the really terrible new recruits that you get and actually turn them into something useful, right? It allows you to generate human capital, right? And a lot of the recruits that they get are pretty bad, are pretty useless when they first show up, right? So eliminating territory, eliminating safe haven does matter. The problem is, even as we are, and we in the grand sense, the Iraqi army, some of the Iranian-backed militias, that are making progress against the Islamic State on the ground in Iraq and some of the other militias that are gaining ground against them in Syria, they are not really in a position where they're going to be able to govern effectively. And the challenge there is that I worry that we are headed into a place where there is going to be a swath of territory in northeastern Syria, northwestern Iraq, where nobody really governs the place. The Islamic State doesn't have total control anymore, but it does have several thousand members sort of scattered across that territory that are able to operate under the radar relatively well. I think it's going to wind up looking a lot like, politically, a lot like the Afghan-Pakistan border region does, where states ostensibly have sovereignty over these places, but subnational groups operate relatively effectively within those territories. And we know just how dangerous places like that can be, because look at the threats that have come out of the Afghan-Pakistan border region. I think that's where we're headed.
Which takes me to the first of the very sharp questions from our audience, which is, what do you see as possible U.S. and world foreign policy stances to help decrease ISIS's power and defeat them? Well done,
that's
whoever
a hard
posed
question.
That.
Thanks very much. Thanks, Corey, for giving me the easy one right off the bat.
No charge, Brian.
Yeah, so, okay, so I'm going to take a step back and evade a little bit and then come back to it. I think the first thing that we need to do for combating the Islamic State is the Congress needs to have a serious debate about whether we're going to authorize military force against this organization. Because we will not defeat this organization unless we as a country are actually politically united in making the commitments necessary to do it. Now, that's not because I want to think we ought to invade Iraq and Syria. That's because right now, and again, this is an Obama administration thing, we have soldiers on the ground in Iraq and Syria in combat, and we are doing so under a legal authorization passed in 2001 to fight the Taliban in Afghanistan. We are driven a semi through this original authorization for force targeted against Al-Qaeda. Never mind that the Islamic State is at war with Al-Qaeda. Right? Now, this may be legal, but this is no political basis for fighting a fight that you actually intend to win. That's a political basis for fighting a fight that you want to fight, but not that you actually want to sustain a commitment over a long period of time or commit the resources necessary to win.
Or persuade allies or enemies
of any of these things. And the dirty secret, in my mind, is that both hawks in the Congress and doves in the Congress don't want to vote on this. Neither of them do. Hawks don't want to vote on it because they don't want to be seen as endorsing a major military intervention in the Middle East again, which obviously would be pretty unpopular. And doves don't want to vote on it because they don't want to vote against an authorization to use military force against an organization that is really, truly, deeply evil. That's a problem. And it speaks to the broader degradation of our political environment, which we don't need to get into now. But that's where it starts. It starts at home. It starts at home, that we can't have an effective foreign policy until we get our stuff together domestically. Now, what do we need to do internationally? First, we need, we need to win militarily in Iraq first. That's step one. And that is progressing. The Iraqi army is moving forward. They are slowly winning in Mosul at tremendous cost. And by the way, with the assistance of Iranian-backed militias that, you know, 8 years ago were killing Americans. So there are a lot of real compromises there. But you have to win in Iraq first. The Iraqi government and the Kurdish regional government, you know, there is a prospect for reasonable governance in Iraq in a way that is not nearly as obvious in northeastern Syria. So that's on the Iraqi side. I'm going to save Syria till the end because I don't have a good answer. The second thing you have to do is you have to maintain and advance relationships with allies around the world at an intelligence sharing level. That's really, really important. And that's a place where, frankly, announcements like the one today about the potential use of torture are not going to help. They are not going to help when it comes to sharing intelligence, even with our most critical allies, because the publics in those places are not going to want to be sharing information with us and getting information back if they believe that it may have been derived from torture.
And the legal authorities in countries like Britain that govern the intelligence sharing will also prohibit it.
That's right. And so this is really critical. This is one of the actual great wins of the last few years, is that we do share intelligence very well with lots of partners around the world. That could go away. That's a real problem from a counterterrorism perspective. Now, the next thing is we have to have a narrative. And what I mean by a narrative is not a PR campaign. We have to stand for something. We have to stand for a better way. And we have to have a foreign policy that reflects that, and we have to present ourselves to the world. I think, you know, we sometimes get into to a position where we say, well, the only people that can push back on the Islamic State are Muslims. And I think that's true from an ideological perspective, you know, from a social perspective in the Middle East. You need local voices and community voices that are going to push back. And there are a lot of them out there. We don't pay very much attention to them. But there are a lot of them out there. And they could be louder, for sure. But we also have to have a voice in the world. We have, you know, we are not seen as the sort of shining beacon of democracy on the hill that we once were, right? And that hurts us because it hurts our ability to rally people. It hurts our ability to tell populations around the world that we will stand with them, that we can show them something better. And that hurts. Now, the last piece is you have to fix Syria. And I don't know what to do there. I don't know who is going to govern northeastern Syria with any kind of clarity and authority going forward. I don't think it's the Assad regime, even if we give them a free rein. It's not going to be Turkey. It's not going to be the Kurdish militias coming into an Arab, primarily Arab region. And there isn't an Arab body in that part of the world that's going to do it. And so I think there is going to be a gap and a black hole of governance in northeastern Syria for a long time. And I think that means that the Islamic State will survive in those places. It will also survive in its distributed sort of affiliates around the world, and they will continue to conduct low-level terror, not even low-level, but conduct significant terrorist attacks, mostly in the region, in Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, et cetera, Iraq, but more widely as well. And this is going to be a problem that we are going to face for years, if not decades. And I think we have to own that. We have to recognize the reality. That's going to happen. And it's only going to kill us if it's only going to kill us, meaning us as a society, as a civilization, if we let it. We can survive. They can't destroy us. But we can destroy ourselves. And that's the plan.
So there are an enormous number of questions and only 17 minutes left in our time
together. So I should be brief.
So you should be brief, Ryan. And that's not going to be easy because so many of these questions are big, broad, important questions, but I am still going to ask you to do so. So the next question is, if a previous speaker here about ISIS said Turkey's crucial to the defeat of ISIS, given Turkey's own problems, what role do you see them playing in the defeat of ISIS?
I see them playing an increasingly important military role, and they will have to be part of the diplomatic solution that leads to some sort of coalition that governs in northeastern Syria. That cannot happen without Turkish acquiescence. They are central to this fight. They also, by the way, essentially let ISIS crisscross their territory for years on their way into Syria because they wanted to see the Assad regime be defeated. And I think you can make a strong argument that they let jihadis operate on their territory for decades going further back. But that's a different story. I don't think you're going to see sort of the close military cooperation that you'd like to see from a NATO ally. I'm not sure that we're going to be able to think about them in that way, the way that we have in the past. But they're fundamental, both from a military standpoint and a diplomatic perspective.
The next question is, what will it take for the internal divisions within ISIS between tribes, Baathists, and foreign fighters to tear it apart?
They are tearing it apart. They are tearing it apart. And I think this is one of the sort of key things about the Islamic State. I mentioned it's sort of populism, right? And that's embodied most by this notion that fighters on the battlefield are assumed to be the most knowledgeable about Islam, the quote-unquote best Muslims, right? And therefore, they can declare, this is something very different from the Zarqawiist movement, gives the authority to fighters on the battlefield the ability to declare another Muslim a non-Muslim and therefore kill them. Al-Qaeda defers that authority, that incredibly important authority, to religious leaders, to very, you know, that make very careful decisions about that. ISIS devolves that authority, and so you can see it can eat itself, right? If I'm having an argument, Corey and I are ISIS fighters, we're having an argument about some other fighter and whether or not we should kill them, whether or not they are really a true Muslim, and I say, yes, they are a true Muslim, let's not kill them. Corey says, no, they're not. Then according to ISIS's ideology, the Zarqawiist thinking, Corey not only can kill them, Corey can kill me because I'm not willing to declare takfir. I'm not willing to declare them a kafir. That's just how like wildly crazy this ideology is. It eats itself. And there's a fundamental tension between that ideology, that organizational ethos, the cult, the organizational culture that produces, and institution building. And this is why the Islamic State as a globe-spanning caliphate is never really going to work. But that kind of ideology doesn't sustain a globe-spanning caliphate, but it's very valuable for sustaining a smaller terrorist network that relies primarily on diehards for its power. And that's another reason why I think this movement is going to persist for a long time, even though I don't see it as a threat to actually establish this caliphate that people have talked about, a sustainable caliphate over the long run.
So amidst all the worrisome, dour, frightening things that we have been talking about, that is one important point to take away, which is the seeds of their failure are inherent in the master plan itself. The likelihood of them persuading Muslims in the Middle East, much less beyond, that, you know, battlefield thugs in the jihadist mode get to subsume the religious authority of in a religious culture of enormous intellectual depth mm-hmm. and breadth. That's the seeds of its own destruction. But as Brian yep. suggests, this is not a near term, in the near term, we are going to be dealing with this for a very long time. Next great question. How can the U.S. defeat ISIS by continuing to support Iranian Shia militia as well as the current Shia government in Iraq? Doesn't our present policy lead to our taking sides in a Shia-Sunni civil war, and maybe we're taking the wrong side? Told you this is a tough crowd.
Yeah, it's a tough crowd. It's a tough question. In the book, I actually describe this process of Iraqi Shia militias going to Iran to be trained in 2007, being flown to Damascus to be trained by Hezbollah in 2007. We know this because That's based on the transcripts of interrogations of those fighters done that were when they were captured in Iraq. So they tell this story. That happened, right? Iran flew these people to be trained by Hezbollah. They went back to Iraq and killed Americans. Now those people, same organizations, are fighting for the Assad regime. Then they're fighting with the Iraqi government. They are the people that have done some of the most, been most successful militarily against the Islamic State. People trained by Iran, trained to kill Americans originally. So there are no good guys. There are no good guys in any of this. I think the thing about those Shia militias is that they are not, they are very, very unlikely to conduct indiscriminate terrorist attacks in nightclubs in Orlando. They're very unlikely to conduct indiscriminate terrorist attacks against, you know, airports in Europe. And they do, they are grounded in a sense of Iraqi nationalism. Even many of the Iraqi Shia militias didn't like the Iranians, right? They took their training, they took their guns, but they didn't like them. And so to conflate all of these people, it's true they're all Shia, but it's not true that just because you're Shia means you like each other, right? There is a sense of Arab nationalism, of Iraqi nationalism, of just different language and culture and history.
It's a terrific book on this subject called In the Rose Garden of the Martyrs.
Yes.
That talks about the cultural and religious differences.
Yeah, and so I think
Iranians and
I think, you know, it is a tough pill to swallow. And you ask a lot of American soldiers who saw people, their friends, their subordinates, their seniors killed by Iranian-backed militias in Iraq, and this is really hard for them to swallow. But I think those militias are allied with the Iraqi government, which is a sovereign government, and they operate under its purview, at least ostensibly under its purview. So this is tough, but I think it's right now it's a necessary compromise.
Next question. So ISIS and Al-Qaeda are mindsets, populism. How does the world ignore them and their drive or momentum, but still be safe and secure, all the while diminishing the mindset and their numbers?
I think that the thing to remember is that the actual committed members of these organizations is still very, very small in the grand scheme of things, right? And, 50,000 people showed up to fight in Syria, most of those with the Islamic State. That's a huge number by the standards of jihadi organizations, right? The biggest number of sort of, you know, Muslim foreign fighters for a jihad like this in the past was in Afghanistan in the 1980s against the Soviet Union. But the best estimates for the number of foreigners that showed up then was about 10,000. So what's happening here in Syria is on a totally different scale. It's on a totally different scale. But compare that to the 6 million Syrians that have fled the country, the vast majority of them Muslim, because they want nothing to do with these people. They're terrified by them, and all they want is a better life for their kids, right? It is simply not true that the Islamic State represents the mainstream in the Muslim world. They don't even represent the mainstream within the jihadi community, right? They're at war with Al-Qaeda because Al-Qaeda sees them as too extreme. And it's also not true that there hasn't been pushback against this group. The problem is that they have an ideology that insulates them from that pushback, that enables them to be a vibrant organization, just not an organization that is going to control the masses. And I think that's the thing. When you have a small group of people willing to use violence indiscriminately, that small group of people can be very, very powerful and very, very dangerous. Because most of us recognize more intense moral limits than the Islamic State does.
Next question. Can you discuss the use, impact, and effectiveness of drones?
So, not across the board, right? I mean, the use of the utility of drones, of UAVs, I think depends entirely on the specifics of what you're trying to do with them and who you're trying to kill with them. I think there is definitely a time and a place to drone people, absolutely. And I think that the use of drones in Pakistan, in particular, has played a great role in the suppression of Al-Qaeda. I think it's very hard when you look at the data to argue otherwise. I really do. And I think the data that suggests that drones have alienated local populations is not as compelling as a lot of folks think it is. In particular, because the studies that a lot of that stuff is based on are really really oftentimes focused on Pakistan and very, very influenced by the Pakistani government, right? You have to think very, very hard about how reliable a study in Pakistan is. That said, you do. I mean, you really do. That said, it clearly pisses people off when, flying machines controlled from Nevada wind up blowing up your neighbor's house, right? And so the trick here is this should be a tool in the arsenal, and it should be a tool that is used sparingly and appropriately when the value is high enough. There has not been a tool in the history of war that is more targeted than a UAV in terms of limiting collateral damage. Really. Now, that's not a defense of the use, the way it's been used always. But there is no other tool where you can sit and watch a place for days sometimes before deciding whether or not it is worth it to pull the trigger on something. So judge the policy. Don't judge the tool. If you're mad with the way the U.S. government has used UAVs, then judge President Obama, who used them more than any other president in history. Fine. But don't say the tool itself needs to be thrown out. I think that's misguided.
Next question. Tulsi Gabbard, Congresswoman from Hawaii and Iraq Army veteran, yeah. American Army veteran who served in Iraq, claims that the U.S. is funding and arming ISIS. Please explain why she is right or wrong.
She's wrong. So it's absolutely true, and it was inevitable, that when the U.S. Has funded some of the Syrian rebel groups, that some of that money, some of those guns, were going to wind up in the arms of other rebel groups. That's just how it works. There is no way to run a military aid provision program where that's not going to happen. So that is just how it works. And so the question was, well, were we going to support any of the Syrian rebels who are fighting what is clearly an autocratic regime that has tortured and suppressed its population for a long, long time and has used chemical weapons against its own people now numerous times in the last couple of years? And I think the Obama administration ultimately decided it was going to provide some assistance, didn't provide enough to actually make a huge difference in the fight. But sure, some of those guns have inevitably wound up in the hands of ISIS, more probably wound up in the hands of the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, which now goes by the name Fatah al-Sham. So that's inevitable. But was there a direct provision to ISIS? No.
Next question. How much is Russia supplanting the U.S. as the primary enemy of ISIS?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually, because the I don't think they're supplanting us as the primary enemy of ISIS. I don't think we are the primary enemy of ISIS, actually. I think the primary enemy of ISIS is the local regimes they want to overthrow. Just like the primary enemy of Al-Qaeda is the local regimes they wanted to overthrow. I think but what's interesting about it is that remember this Al-Qaeda strategy was to attack the United States because we were propping up the local regimes, right? Well, it's Russia that's propping up the local regime in Syria, very clearly. I think Russia is going to feel the heat from that. They already are in Syria, and they have in the past in Chechnya. I think they're going to feel that again in the future. And that's just inevitable reality. The problem with ISIS is big enough and strong enough that it is going to be able to direct attacks against multiple targets at the same time. That's something that Al-Qaeda didn't always have the ability to do. It didn't have the same reach that the Islamic State does. The Islamic State has more people speaking more languages with more backgrounds and more passports than the Al-Qaeda ever had. So they just have more of a breadth. They can target the United States, they can target Europe, they can target Russia simultaneously.
So last question, since we are down to our last couple of minutes in our time together, and it takes this discussion into a different realm, one where you do more work now, Brian, which is, in your opinion, how does the U.S. balance First Amendment rights and the right to privacy with security, particularly when it comes to internet content, be it Facebook, Twitter, YouTube? What responsibility do tech companies have to stamping out hate speech?
Well, I think that, so full disclosure, I manage policy around terrorism at Facebook. There's two issues. One is the responsibilities the U.S. government has, which I think is to uphold the First Amendment and abide by it, which allows for a lot of nasty speech, as we know. I think technology companies don't have that same responsibility. They have terms of service. We certainly do at Facebook. Every other company, well, not some of the little guys, but most large companies do as well. And I think we have the responsibility to our community to make sure that people feel safe and that they have the ability to share and engage with their friends, families, and networks in an arena where they are not bombarded by beheadings and hate speech all of the time, bullying, sextortion, all of the sorts of nasty things that happen on the internet sometimes. We do have that responsibility, and I can only speak for Facebook. We take it very seriously. Terrorism is not has no place on Facebook, and support, praise, representation of terrorist organizations or terrorist attacks or specific terrorists is not allowed. So I think there is a larger question here and a tricky one of, well, how do technology companies make sure that the specter of terrorism isn't used to suppress legitimate dissent? And that's a more difficult one. I also think that technology companies have a responsibility to their users, to their community, to defend them from that kind of suppression. And we certainly take that just as seriously at Facebook.
I'm Corey Shockey from the Hoover Institution. I have been talking with Brian Fishman, the author of Master Plan. And this, you have been with us at the Commonwealth Club of California. Please follow us on Twitter, follow us on Facebook, join in our conversations in person or virtually. Thank you for being with us, Brian Fishman.
Thank you.